direct from the web. It's Billy Masters live.
Oh my God, we're live.
And now, please welcome your host, Billy Masters.
Oh, I've got a hot mic. Hey everybody, where is everybody? Hey everybody, welcome to Billy Masters Live. Oh my God, I look a little bit like a burn victim. What has happened? You know, I looked so good in the lighting test earlier, and now I look flush. It must be that Levi crisis here. Oh, anyway, thank you. I guess we must move on with the show, regardless of my lighting. Today is Thursday. Thank you, Monica. May 5th. Welcome to Billy Masters Live. I am, of course, the very flushed Billy Masters. So let me explain to you what happened. Yesterday, I was traveling, and Levi and I had arranged this interview, I don't know, like 2 weeks ago. It's been on the agenda. And he'll explain to me, I think he had a student matinee today. And we're like, oh, well, we can't do it. And we could have pre-taped it, but I was traveling all day yesterday, so I wasn't around anywhere to do it. And then, of course, at night he had a show. So we said, well, what about just doing it later? Because, you know, I'd rather be live with you than not live. And, you know, when we started this show, it really was started because everyone was stuck at home during the pandemic. They couldn't go out. And people kept saying to me they were bored. They had nothing to do. And I said, well, if you got nothing to do, I am better. See, one thing I know about myself, I am better than nothing. And if you argue that point, then turn on another show. Ha, there aren't any more. So anyway, it had to be live because people were sitting home. Now people are back at work. And what's really, and I have to thank those of you watching this, because even though like practically nobody watches live, but on the weekends, the numbers jump and we get thousands of people on Saturday and Sunday. So I thank you all for being here, even on the weekends. So I am still Billy Masters Live because if I'm here, I'm live. But you're not watching Billy Masters Live. You're watching Billy Masters tape. You know, is Levi getting in his steps? What is happening over there? My God, he's crazy. Anyway, there's already a comment. Go, go, go. All right, I'm going. You know, I love it when you interact, but you know, go, go, go. All right, anyway. Levi Christ is such a great friend of mine. He has been on this show before, and I did find this picture, which I think sort of sums up. It was taken the day I met Levi. This is 2007, LA Pride. So, oh my God, 2007, that is such a long time ago. Look at you, Levi. Look, there's the yellow, the crack security we had at LA Pride. If you had a yellow wristband, you had all access. Boy, we thwarted those terrorists. Anyway, please welcome the lovely, the talented Levi Christ. Hey, Levi.
Hey, how are you?
So did you have
hair? I got show hair. We just finished a matinee for the student matinee.
The students? Oh my God, how'd it go? I talked to a group of, we almost saw each other in Boston. We just missed each other. And a friend of mine who's at Boston Conservatory, a group of them went to see Hadestown at the Opera House in Boston. And so many of the, you know, you guys gave them like student discounts and all that stuff, which is great. Yes. But they loved it so much. They went back on closing night to see it again.
Cool.
So, I mean, is that the kind of response you get from kids? Because this really does have the energy, this youthful energy of reinterpreting a tale as old as ancient Greece, as you and
I
know.
We do get that response from a lot of kids, a lot of high school, right up through college age. I mean, they'll come back three or four times. I mean, they're like huge.
Really?
Show, yeah.
So let's explain to people, I mean, in a nutshell, this is the Orpheus and Eurydice story.
Yes.
But is it reset in, where is it set in? I mean, it's still Hades, but it's sort of Southern, right?
It is it is Hades Town, yes, but there is a New Orleans flavor to the piece. And obviously we have to go back to how it originated, which is Anais Mitchell and her music. And she is an Americana artist. So while Hades Town as a whole is rather genre bending, right? You don't you don't sit in the blues the whole time. You don't sit in folky Americana world the whole time, but it borrows from everything that is a part of our Americana music roots. For that, obviously, it was very appetizing for me. So it makes sense that it would fit in an area like New Orleans and have a little bit of that aesthetic to bring to the table. It just gives it a real accessible feel. And then you've got this incredible story of, like, you've got the Orpheus and Eurydice story here. That love story is beautiful all on its own. And Hermes had a very important part in helping navigate that love in Greek mythology. And then you have Persephone and Hades, and they, with the strain of her now spending 6 months of the year down below instead of, you know, we're missing spring now, there's no spring or fall anymore. The strain on their relationship is heightened. So you're following these love stories. One is budding and new and runs into a lot of conflicts that are happening present time.
In real time, right.
In Hades, yeah. So like you see the conflict immediately with Persephone and Hades, and then you realize this young couple is going to just like barge right into all of its drama, and will they survive?
And, you know, what's really interesting, and I think that you've made a little bit of history in this, is that you are replacing somebody probably the polar opposite of you, you know, who originated the role, correct?
Correct. Well, actually, if I recall, the actor, and his name escapes me, Chris, This Is Us. He's one of the actors, the bearded guy on a series regular on This Is Us, but he originated the role originally.
Oh, okay.
In the previous workshops. He was very folksy with it, you know, but then once they got to Broadway, Andre DeShields, who, you know, I think many of us know him from The Wiz and his success there, kind of gave it his own stamp.
Right. And really, that was the first one that most of the people saw.
Sure.
And again, a legendary performer. Also, first off, let's point out Black. Mm-hmm. Second, older.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to say he's in the 70s. Is he 60s?
He's pretty close. Yeah, if not. Okay. And an amazing dancer, which, by the way, I had no idea how good a dancer you are from what I've seen. But, you know, they say, you know, well, let's find somebody who's going to replace an iconic Black singing dancer and let's go with you.
Showman is the operative word there. And I knew I knew that they needed a showman for this. And that is what I do. People come to me when they need that thing. As far as an actor is concerned, I kind of like seem to be called in a lot for showmen kind of men.
Did you pitch yourself? Were you approached? How did it work?
You know, I thought it was a very creative submission that my agent did. I just think that it was so really creative. And then
outside the box,
it was outside the box, but it wasn't, because the music is so in my wheelhouse that, like, that was really the selling point. When I opened my mouth and I sang this stuff, they
Chris
were like
Sullivan.
Yeah. I think actually Anais Mitchell like stopped the audition and shouted a couple of expletives when she
really,
yeah. So, I mean, the music's just tailor-made for me. So like that immediately, you need something, I think, like that to be able to say, hey, I'm not Andre. I'm doing it a different way, and you're coming with me, you know.
And let's just show people here. Talk about a polar opposite. It's like a negative of a photo, like an X-ray. And yet, just because the look is just different doesn't mean that you can't do it. And as you said, put your own spin on it.
I love that photo so much. So it was the sweetest day. We were meeting.
Oh, what happened?
And we were leaving rehearsal to meet the cast, and you know, we had to stay separate from COVID and everything, but he was just like, he knew I waved and I was fine with the wave, and he was like, made his way, walked straight over to me, gave me a big hug, and I said, well, I guess I've got to figure out what this is for me, hon. And he was just like the sweetest. He was just the sweetest and so supportive. And I felt the support, and it meant the world to me for him to be just so paternal about it in a way. And so, but I have to give credit to the creative team, because every role, not just the role of Hermes, but Orpheus as well, Eurydice, we're allowed to bring such a unique take to these roles. And it really has been great that we've had that freedom, because when you see our show, you're seeing the same story. Nothing is lost. Mm-hmm. I think Helen Hunt actually said it perfectly last week when she saw the show and she posted it and said, nothing is lost, but I've never had this experience before where I've seen a show on Broadway and then I've seen the touring cast, and it was like over the top, insane production with everybody killing it and still so different than the original cast.
And let's show a little clip of you in action in Hadestown at the Amundsen Theater. Okay, here we go.
Everybody hungry, everybody tired, everybody saved by the sweat of his brow. The wage is nothing, the work is hard, it's a graveyard in Hadestown.
Hadestown, Hadestown, way down under the
You just look like you're having so much fun.
That's a fun number. That's a fun.
And we should point out that you're playing in Los Angeles through May 29th. And if people want tickets, centertheatergroup.org. And this is the national tour. So you've been doing this show how long now?
It's
9 months?
September. Yes.
Wow. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
What have you learned about doing the show on the road? Because you and I know shows change, shows become, especially when you have a different cast, it becomes this whole new animal based on the energy. So what has changed in the audience? We should also throw in, people are dying to go to shows because they couldn't go anywhere for two years.
Yes. Well, that is the start of it, right? In the fact that when we started touring this in September and October, I start the show. I walk right up to the lip of the stage. I feel them out. I draw them right in to get this show started. But it was so much more than just that, because the moment I would plug into the audience, I would feel this wave of appreciation for being back in theater, you know? Right. And I knew that we were, it would choke us up, but then it would continue. Every city, we were people's first show back. So that was a really special thing. As far as like, how do you keep it fresh after you've done that sort of thing? I'm a digger. I'm a very forensic Scorpio. So like, I'm never satisfied with my character. I will do enough to really like pull it together and know how to honor the role and honor the script, but I just get hungry. And I just, and I love to know more and more and more, because those prior instants before scenes that you pop into, certain memories that pop you into focus. Like, I don't want to use the same one for 10 months. I want to use a different memory, a different this, a different that. So you're always like,
and try, see what works.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, so I kind of love keeping the imagination rolling on my character, and just, and today even it helps me just to be a super active listener, you know, and like just allow anything to take you in a different direction. So I never get tired of that. I mean, you think about other roles that I've, you know, I love originating.
I was just saying, how long were you in Million Dollar Quartet?
Oh, like from 2004 to 2010. Yeah, that's when the first workshop was. So for me, it was like, you know, you have so much time to find all the little nuances. And I feel really only in the last 2 months do I feel like I'm owning him now.
Mm.
Yeah.
And he's your Hermes.
Yes.
How much of it did you, you know, when you're taking over somebody, a role that somebody else has done, particularly somebody who's done it iconically, do you see that that works for them and say, how can I make it work for me? Or do you want to start from zero and find it all yourself?
I know my forte is originating roles, and my focus has always been new works. So while I don't have a list of Broadway credits as long as my arm, I have a list of workshops as long as my arm. And like, some of my favorite roles have been roles that people have yet to see. Like I loved playing a role of Jack the Ripper in
right. I remember talking to
like a lot of people may not hear about, but like, so, but when you do get to do that, it ends up something like Million Dollar Quartet. So I love investing in original roles. So for me, approaching it from that perspective of knowing my strengths and my point of view, I'm a very self-aware actor. Like I know where my strengths are. I know where my weaknesses are. I know how to capitalize them on them. I know how to make them a commodity. And I teach that with a lot of actors in masterclasses at colleges, because that helps us, right? Then define a role and make it our own so that no one else can come along and really do it quite
do early. What you do.
Yeah.
And also pivot. You know, one of the things about that a lot of friends of mine who do long runs is they find that something that worked for them just suddenly no longer works for whatever reason. And you never find it. But you, if you're open to it, you'll find new things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that never stops. Right. I mean, if you're
right,
that just keeps going. I'm just never going to be I've never taken on a role and thought like, OK, I'm satisfied. I mean, not even in the eight years or so with Jerry Lee Lewis. I continue to find things that made him very lovable to the audience. You know, it was never about him being cocky. It was never about him being arrogant. It was always about him being just like an eager puppy dog, right? But like, that's a very nuanced distinction between, I think, a lot of people who came up behind me and played him afterwards may not have seen that nuance. That is the difference in the audience laughing at you and not rooting for you, or
right
with you and rooting for you. Right.
How aware of that nuance are you when you're on stage? Do you feel the audience?
By the time I do the work, I think especially with this, this is a very interesting dance for me with Hermes, because generally I have a very fourth wall. Like every audience is going to experience a role differently, and I don't want to be invested in that. It's sort of like the second agreement and the four of agreements. Don't take anything personally, right? I don't know what they're thinking. I don't want to know how they're feeling. I want to be true to the role. I want to hide in the role. Just be the role. Be the role, be specific. But with Hermes, I am their guide. I have to break that fourth wall and really be involved in them. So that's where me as a singer-songwriter and someone who's been touring my own stuff since I was 12 years old comes in handy. Because then I can kind of sense, are they going to be slow coming to the table? Or are they already right in the palm of my hand the instant I start? Like, where are they and how do I get them there is just a thing I've been feeling out since I was a kid. So I do love being able to lean into that with Hermes. It kind of helps me.
When you're performing your own solo stuff, you have more latitude because you can shift on a dime depending on what's working. In a role, you still, while you have some freedom, you are in a structured show.
Yes, for sure. For sure. Yeah.
You know, and, you know, again, you did point it out. Let's just point out somebody does have a Tony Award.
Look at that smile. What a happy day that was.
That is somebody who's happy. And I'm curious, you know, you and I have talked about these workshops that have gotten close and then never gotten there. And so many of them still could happen, as you and I know. Yes. But this has happened. So this is, you know, for a lot of people who haven't seen you for a while, this is like a comeback to a staged musical.
To a stage musical, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And people are very excited about it because since Violet, I think, was...
Oh, God.
2014 or something. I mean, still. Yeah. So that was like, what? That's like maybe 7 years ago now?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So that was my last... It wasn't my
scripted
last.
Show.
It wasn't Book my last show. Theater show. That was my last Broadway theater show. I had done some regional since Violet, but yeah, that it is nice to be back in the theater.
I'm curious, when you go into a show now and you are a Tony winner, and you know that is something to be very proud of, and it's something that's advertised starring Tony winner. Does that put pressure on you, or is that just that's that, and this is this?
I used to let it put pressure on me more than I do now, because I adopted this idea that everybody was now projecting these illogical expectations on me, when truthfully I'm just have a very slow process in finding a character, and I'm okay with my pace. When I find it, though, it's deep. It's wide, it's rich, it lasts, but there's a lot of other actors who get there a little faster. I mean, I'm me, and that's the thing. I've had to like accept the fact that what I do is good, but what I do is how I do it is how I do it, and it's okay. And I can't worry about what people think, how people think I should behave because of my accolades.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, I also there are going to be people, you know, you're in an interesting position. I don't want to say weird, because I think that everybody's position is their own. And because you're a solo artist as well, you may have people coming to see you because they know you from your solo work. And then they're getting this whole other person because you are a character now. Absolutely. Doing music that is different than your own voice, but you are still inhabiting it.
Absolutely. And that's so fun. I mean, there's a lot of people seeing. This is the great thing about this tour is it's going to cities that I have not had the opportunity to tour as often.
Oh.
So I have fans in a lot of these cities who are like, this is their first time seeing me live even. So like they may not have come to Hadestown unless I was a part of it, because they've been a fan of mine for years. So like that has been really fun, because I've been able to hug a lot of necks, shake a lot of hands, fans who have been there for years who've never had the opportunity to see me do anything live.
Is that also, you know, does that put pressure on you to just fulfill their expectations? Or in a way, is it a gateway to opening their experiences to Broadway musicals?
As far as my attitude about the show that evening, when I know that they're there, I just kind of like get really joyful. I just get really happy and celebrate the fact that I get to share this with somebody who's listened to one of the ones in 2005, you know? So like, I feel giddy about it. Those are not the times I have performance anxiety. The times I have performance anxiety are when like our creative team is sitting with a notepad, you know, saying, you held this phrase a microsecond too long, you know, that kind of thing. No, I celebrate it. I think it's great. And I think it's great to see the other direction too, where have we a lot of people who only know from theater, who heard my music, who saw Hadestown and came over and joined my membership site and dove into all my archives and are now fans of my music.
And we should point out your website, because your website is so extraordinary. You interact with people. You will perform live concerts. You do special events. You pull things out of archives that, like, would shock people. And you're also...
I think
you
probably should stay there, too.
Well, I don't know. I think, you know, I love when every once in a while you'll bring out a clip and say, I can't believe I'm going to show this, but... You know, I think that are you able to do a lot of that while you're on the road?
Not as much as I'd like to, you know, because I'm also trying to spend time writing my own musical right now, which I will be going into whenever I leave my Hadestown family. And that's probably going to be what I invest in for the next 5 years. It's going to be with a new album, but I'm writing the music to the musical. I have a book writer. We're working on the book. We've already had three workshops for it.
Oh, wow.
So like, we're far along. We want our first audience in somewhere obscure, like, just to test things out in March.
Sure, of course.
So I'm hoping.
What would that be? Would that be autobiographical? Is it an original story?
It is autobiographical, but not in the conventional sense of autobiographical musicals or plays. We're using some theatrical tools that make it very interesting, very, very different. I don't know that the audience will really know that it is until they know that it is.
Well, thank you for being so vague. if people want that kind of insight, they can go to your website, levichrist.com. And you're also on social media. You're great on social media. So people should follow you because you really keep people in the loop. And as I said, you're so grateful to your fans, which, you know, you and I know a lot of people who take them for granted. And you really don't. I've never seen that.
Oh, my God. Well, I think, in all honesty, I think it's just a response to going through, you know, my history, a total over the years of the like 98 to like maybe 2004, I went through like 8 major record labels. And every time that they discovered my sexual identity, the marketing team didn't know what to do. People didn't know what to do. That we weren't out then in not in major mainstream labels. I mean, you would have your success and then come out.
But you were a niche artist.
But I was starting out, and no one was starting out gay then. So for me, the fact that I was able to find a fan base that would support me, like, why would I not even to this day love them up? Because that to me means the world to me. Like, they are my label. They are the reason I get to do what I do, because I didn't get a break. I didn't get a chance from any team, not even a manager, you know? So, I mean, like, it's been truly DIY. DIY for 15 years, for 15 years. It's crazy.
Well, they found one way to market you because there were ads like this.
Where do you get this stuff?
Look, I'm sorry. And so I was looking at this. I didn't know about these credits. Like, were you were like on soaps and shows and movies.
Yeah.
And you just were, again, a working actor doing what you can. And, you know, again, when you have, you know, an album cover like this, for instance. Now, not everybody would be quite so literal to take the flip side that way. And yet, certainly, you look good, and why not?
Well, you know, interesting thing enough, that whole album was fan crowdfunded, and the names that are written on my body are the names of every person who donated to make the album.
Wow, really?
So
I didn't know that.
They could get the name, they could get the album. Like, they could have it and stream it, but you gotta get the actual copy so that you can have a copy of your name on there.
Oh, wow.
You so you can find any donor, any person who was part of that Kickstarter campaign can find their name on my body.
Wow. And could you ask like where you'd want to be, like on your left thigh or something?
Well, no, I left that to my discretion, and there were
people
I did place like over my heart or other places.
Was that it must have been a really long process though, in terms of prep and you know, shooting and everything. I just can't imagine, because you got to lay it out as well.
Well, the first time we laid it out, it shot completely wrong. It was just too much space between the names. I couldn't get all the names on, so I literally had to wash all of it off, start again, reapply in a way that actually made it shootable. So,
how do you spend your time when you're on the road with shows like this? Are you somebody who can explore a city and do things, or do you really have to stay home and say, look, I gotta prepare and save everything for the show?
Yeah. This is definitely a save everything show. I mean, it's a 2.5 hour show. I never leave stage. This is the highest stuff that I've ever sang. I'm just constantly.
Oh, really? Is that true?
Up here. So like vocally, I have to be a ninja to get through the show. Because I turn it into a really vocal show for Hermes. And then with writing the musical, you know, it's like I'm doing that when I'm not self-caring, and when I'm not self-caring, I'm on stage. So I never really get to go out.
Are you getting time off? Do you, or is, because I know with show, especially tours, time is money. I mean, you can't have a down week, because what do you do with everyone?
Yeah, we had a week in April and we had a week in December.
Yeah. That's your vacation. That's
and
it.
That's all. That's all.
You know, be careful what you wish for, right?
Right, right. Yeah.
Do you like being on the road, or do you prefer being in one city like a Broadway run?
I will never tour again with a corporate, with a big, I would tour. Well, I will be touring with my own musical, but then right. I'm the boss. So I get to choose accommodations. I get to take care of myself in the way that I want to take care of. But as far as like touring again, I'll never do that again with a Broadway show. I do like sitting in one spot. It makes it really so much easier to maintain the other aspects of my life. Touring nearly makes it impossible for me to keep up with the music, the membership site, the merchandising, the new double live album that just came out on USB. It's like I have a lot of things I want to keep in the forefront. And it's just that extra added thing that, like, when you're always going to have to pack back up and go to a different city every Monday, you're never getting a day off, really, because your day off's a travel day. And there's only so much time in a day, you know?
Yeah, and I would also think that since you're planning ahead, how do you ever take a day off? Because there's always something that you need to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
You know, and you are your own boss. So, I mean, if you're not working, nothing's going to get done.
I kind of got used to that too, Billy. And so now I kind of don't like being employed.
You know, we're very spoiled, those of us who are self-employed.
Because, like, when you've learned how to make it work, like, you then really have more opinions about how other people should be doing things rather than being a nice, obedient employee. I mean, like, I just want to rebel, you know?
Like, yeah, well, and I also know so many performers who are like, you know, especially on Broadway, they're like, I know I have to work for 3 hours. The rest of the day is mine, however I structure it. Uh-huh. And that is a great schedule to be on if you're it in is. New York. When you're on the road, that is not the case.
That's not the case.
Because there's a lot of press. And that's the other thing. There's a huge, because you have to start from scratch in every city. How long have you here in LA? When did you get here? 2 weeks ago?
Yes, 2 weeks
ago. Okay, so it's like 6 weeks in LA, which is a nice long sit-down run.
Yeah, it is.
You know, are most places like a week?
Yeah, most of them are just a week. I mean, LA feels home to me because I lived here for so long. So it's kind of nice. I get to see a lot of friends and, you know, feel loved, you know, feel the love.
Well, and people can also come and see you, which is lovely. As I said, I haven't seen you since Million Dollar Quartet, seen you on stage. Now that, yes, that was the last time I saw you. So, and we should also point out that you are married.
Yes.
And so how is that on your personal life touring?
It comes with me.
Oh, is he on the road with you? He's an artist, right?
He'll be walking through the door any minute.
Oh, okay.
From his yoga class. Yes.
Oh, so it's a tough life, Levi.
Well, we try to manage to where we don't want to be more than 2 weeks apart. So, and that's fine because I'm a workaholic, so I can manage like getting work obsessed for 2 weeks. And then by that time I'm pulling my head out of my projects and I'm looking around like, I want to be like, where's my husband? So, and gratefully he's remote. So he's able to come where I am. And we've just managed to just make it work. And we prefer it that way. We don't like to be apart.
Is it a big shift after being in COVID lockdown where you really couldn't do anything to suddenly go from nothing to every minute is kind of work?
Oh God, that keeps me grateful for sure.
Really?
Like, probably all of us, right? Because all we have to do is sit back and think about when nothing was happening and be like, okay, I am not complaining.
Well, because I remember when we talked before that you were doing, was it like a concert every week or something?
Concerts every month.
It was crazy.
Song commissions. I was writing and recording songs for people. And yeah, I was doing a lot of.
You really made a lot of your own opportunities. And I think that, you know, that's one of the good things that came out of COVID was I think a lot of us who said, okay, I'm not going to sit home, so let's figure something out. The people who were creative really came up with some innovative ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And some fun ideas. And some funny ideas, which I'll leave to someone else to discuss.
I have to read something because my friend Karen Salkin, I have to get my other computer up. She went to see you on opening night. Well, apparently it's not here, but she reviewed you opening night here in LA, and she quoted your Tony Award winning speech where you thanked your, was it a reverend minister?
I did. At one point in the speech, I thanked a reverend, yeah.
And there was a line, and I don't have it in front of me. Do you remember what it was?
Where there were two friends of mine who I had started. They're metaphysical teachers, so they're not like traditional reverends in that sense. They are reverends from the Centers for Spiritual Living, a spiritual center. And I had just been maybe 18 months sober when the Tony Award happened.
Oh, God.
And they had helped me get to that point. And so I said something to the effect of like, thank you for helping me become more available to my good.
And that's exactly the quote. I just found it now. Yeah. So there you go. I had to put on the glasses to find it, but she just said that, I'm just going to read Levi Christ, blah, 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 Master of Ceremonies, blah, blah, blah. I've known him since he was Tony Award for Million Dollar Quartet a dozen years ago because he accepted his award. He made a thoughtful statement which impressed me. He thanked someone for making me more available to my good. I love that. I only wish that somebody would do that for me. And what I thought when I read that is, I think that when you hear something like that, one of the things that if that is indeed what you want, is sometimes you have to be that person for yourself.
Absolutely, on a daily basis. And I think, you know, in today's world, we talk a lot about like self-love and, you know, or girl power and all this sort of stuff. And like it becomes like a meme, really, without any sort of context in life. And the context I like to offer in the topic of self-love is that it is an action verb. It is, and sometimes it's just straight out discipline, showing up for yourself. Showing up to meditate every day. For me, mm-hmm. showing up to the gym every day, doing the things that make my mind feel healthy and my heart feel healthy and my body feel good. Those things take discipline. Self-care is
a job. It's a full-time job.
Job. It really is. If you're going to go body, mind, spirit holistically, it's something you have to participate in, you know?
Yeah, I know that so many people will take care of their physical body. They'll go to the gym, they'll get on a routine, but they will still talk about how unhappy they are or how bored they are or how they want this. And I'm like, well, what are you doing for that? Because you know, you say, I want this chest or these arms, and then you do something for it.
Yeah.
Well, if you feel empty inside, what are you going to do for that?
Yeah. Oh, we can only fix ourselves. That's the thing.
Yeah. But what's interesting is that, you know, in that Tony speech, you know, what you're pointing at is that you had people who helped show you the way.
I had road signs. Yeah.
But you still have to be willing to read the sign and go where the sign's pointing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
You know, and I think that so many people think that there's a quick fix for things and that, oh, I just need someone to give me the key and then I'll be all set. And I'm like, the key doesn't do anything unless you put it in a door and turn it.
Yes, yes.
One of our
Which is great to know friends. Because when I want to aw shucks, is what I say. When I want to aw shucks my way out of something and like just maybe like put on that faux Southern humility thing, I have to actually stop and say, no, Levi, give yourself the credit. You know, you had people showing you signs, but you did the work to get sober. You did the work to, you know, invest in a quality of life that is loving. You did the work, you know, so you did the work, Billy. It's like, you know, we can't just write that off. I just feel like in my past, I've been too quick to give everybody else the credit and not stop and realize that I've done the work.
Yeah, I know that it seems to me, I'm this way, and I know a lot of people are, that they're very quick to give themselves the blame, take the blame, but not give themselves the credit, or they're converse. They give themselves a lot of credit and no blame. And I'm like, you know, if you're going to do one, you've got to look at both.
Yeah.
Because they're the flip sides of the same coin.
For sure. For sure. Yeah.
You know, one of our mutual friends just wrote something, and Kenny Morse, one of the sweetest, most talented guys I ever met. Great to see you, Levi.
So, hi, Kenny.
You know, and you know, that's the other thing is that when I talked about, you know, we've talked about this before, when we did Pride, which I can't believe is 2007. I mean, it just seems bizarre to me. It's like another world.
Yeah.
But I remember because I had known you before, we didn't get to know each other, but I was always happy to see somebody who kept plugging away. And careers are made on levels, I really think, and that you can get to a level. Hopefully you don't get too comfortable there because then you'll never challenge yourself to that next level. Yeah. But, you know, doing Pride, I had seen you in coffee shops and clubs around town for years.
And
that was a level. And you had also had a CD. And I'm like, where is he going to end up? And what year was the Tony Award?
That was 2010, actually.
So, I mean, that's a very short time.
Yeah.
You know, I know that at the time, nothing ever seems like it's quick.
No, and I think that you can't take those levels seriously either. It's like, because careers are an ebb and flow, always an ebb and flow, right?
That's true.
We get in trouble when, I think a lot of younger actors and artists get in trouble when they try to have this concept that I will arrive if this happens, but they don't realize that when that happens, it is a down. And then it's probably, you know, maybe a little bit more of an up and then maybe in a down. And it's just, it's this. If you're doing it for 20, 30, 40 years, it's going to look like this. And there are times
and it should
be super impressed with this. And then they'll hate you when you're at your low and think he's a wash up. And then this will happen. And then they'll love you again. And then they'll think you're a wash. And then, you know, it is just like you can't tune everybody out because you only know when you're in it for decades that you never take those highs and lows seriously. You just keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, but the thing is, I also think that when you're in the midst of it, it's really hard to remember that. You know, it's always easy to remind yourself of these things when it's a good time.
Yes, it is true. That's a good point. Yeah.
I'm just curious, you know, your career has been so steady. You're always working. You're always producing. What is your personal life like? Because obviously I know you're married, but do you ever just say to yourself, you know, for 6 months, I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to chill and relax and enjoy life and hike or something.
I think I would go crazy if I didn't have anything to do. Yeah, I really do think I would. I think I love what I do, and it's my creative outlet. I have a feeling that I just wouldn't feel expressed if I couldn't be doing something. I also know that I'm so passionate about what I do that I wish I could be a better friend sometimes, you know, because I'm learning. Especially as we learn in recovery, that sometimes those of us who are in recovery think the world revolves around us a lot. And so I'm really trying to always be mindful of that and realize things aren't always about my schedule, what I need to get done, and just like try to be there for those that I love a little better. I mean, I feel like I've been slow on the uptake.
Really?
Because also in context, it's like my mental health and well-being was better off cutting the cord with my family. Mm-hmm. And so right. I, through my young adult life, I didn't have anybody but me to answer to. As I was coming of age, you know, I had friends, we were doing the same things and shared the same creative expressions, you know, kicking around LA, all of us being singer-songwriters and that sort of stuff. But like, as far as I was concerned, that umbilical cord was cut. And like, I didn't mm-hmm. feel a sense of obligation or investment in the concept of family. So I think one of the things that has been a long learning curve for me, being married to someone who is very family oriented, mm-hmm. is just, I mean, just to cultivate the idea of becoming thoughtful. It's like, and I feel frustrated at times because honestly, I'm not a great person with like, I can't think of like great presents to get, or at the time I'm just so scattered. I'm trying to be better at remembering, you know, when certain important events are, but it's like, I'm not going to give up just because it doesn't come natural to me. Because when it lands, it's food for my soul and food for the other person's soul. But yeah, I feel like to answer your question, I mean, like it has been a journey for me to come out of my shell and to participate in the lives of those that I love. Yeah.
You know, we're coming into, you know, it's May. Before you know it, we're going to be in Pride Month. And I'm always happy when I talk to people who took those steps to come out early in their career, because I think it's very easy once you have a Tony to come out. I think it's very brave to come up as an unknown and expect people to still take that chance on you, because show business is business. Mm-hmm. And I never forget that. So, but could you even envision your life not being out?
Not today. I think that there's always a part of me who's going to look back and wonder, had I not spent a great deal of my 20s not having the opportunities that people in their 20s who have a well-cultivated talent like I had to offer in my 20s, where would I be? But then it would have been a whole other thing. Okay, so let's say none of the record labels didn't run. They weren't afraid of me being openly gay. And here in the 2000s, I had all of my hits and pop music. And so where would I be now in 2022? Trying to do a musical to do something relevant again. You know, it's like, so who's to say one is better than the other is better? Like, so it's like, you can't play the game of what ifs. You just have to realize that as long as you've kind of honored yourself, you know, along the way, I guess that's all that matters.
What would you tell? I mean, I'm sure people must ask you, especially young gay performers, when they ask you for advice. And, you know, it seems so trite to say, well, you got to follow your heart. You got to do what you think is right for you. But I used to get messages, because I've been writing the column for 22 years. Yeah. Before there was an internet, and people would write me. And it was a huge responsibility, because you don't know where they're coming from and you don't know what's right for everybody. And, you know, I was always very wary about it, other than saying to reach out for help around you and yeah. guidance around you. But for performers, what do you tell people now?
Well, you really did kind of say it, and that I think it's different for everyone. But because it's different for everyone, I would tell anyone to like really know your voice, know what mm-hmm. your message is, know what is your language, your point of view, your ministry, your brand culture, your vibe. It's like we live in a day and age now where it's we're free. I mean, like the democratization of music, because of YouTube, the democratization of video content, like we're really only limited by ourselves. And the better we know what we have to offer and what that looks like in the world, the more opportunities we're going to be able to create for ourselves.
Yeah, I also think that, as you said, that the platforms that were available to you, you know, 15, 20 years ago were yeah. so different. I mean, business yeah. has changed enormously, and the power has been given back to the artists in so many ways.
Absolutely. I never thought I'd see a day and age like this. Like, from my perspective, when we always needed gatekeepers or those who could cut the red tape. Like, I can't believe that I can create a marketing funnel and bring new fans into my music through a music video ad funnel. It's like the fact that I can do that, it's like crazy. It's like you could sit here and just reach new fans with the right strategy. And like, that never would have been the case.
You know, Faith, you and I have talked about Faith in the past, and you know, Faith has changed for so many people over the years into you know, something that we don't have to label, that it can be very personal for each of us. And what is Faith for you? Because you've gone through so much. I don't want to make it like, oh my God, it was this terrible experience, but everybody's journey is a lot, particularly when you look at it for over, say, two decades. How has your faith changed? Yeah. And is it more based on you?
It's definitely not religiosity anymore, even though I have healed my religious wounds well enough to where I, frankly, very much enjoy going old school every now and then when it comes to a prayer, certainly with gospel music, which is a mainstay in my listening, my playlists and stuff and things I listen to. It lifts me up and really gets me in the right frame of mind to be of service through any role, Hermes or whatever. But for me personally, it's very metaphysical in that I believe there is only one power and one presence in this universe. It's an infinite intelligence. You see it operating in nature everywhere you are, and we're not separate from nature. So that impulse to requalify itself to a state of wholeness at all times is the very energy that is within me. And the more I lean into it, the more I see it exhibit in my life, you know. And I believe that our thoughts, feelings, and beliefs create our reality. I believe in the law of attraction. And I believe that I am the creator of this. A drop in the ocean is not the whole of the ocean, but within it contains all the properties of the ocean. And so I am as a breath of God, you know.
And are you able to tap into that when your faith is challenged?
That's the time to do it. I mean, like, all that stuff doesn't mean anything when, like, it's all roses. It's like,
yeah, right.
You know, honestly, it's like I've been real stubborn about that, in that I think that in order for these things to really, first of all, I believe that if spirituality is not actually improving the quality of your life, your body, mind, and spirit, the quality of your mental health, your physical health, your emotional health, your financial health, your relationship health, then what is it doing? If you're just showing up to church.
But that's all relationships in your life.
Yeah, right? Yes. I mean, for me, it's not enough to just go to a building and go through a ritual. I want to know that what I'm doing is actually helping me be in a better mindset at work, or learn compassion for someone who's not very nice to me, or attract greater abundance financially, or whatever the case may be. So yeah, I think it is in the experience of contrast that we get to use these tools more intricately and really see that they work.
Well, and it kind of brings us back to Hadestown, because, of course, Hadestown is based on Greek gods, and it is the foundation of so many religions.
Yes.
And, one of the things I love about the Orpheus story is it is about faith. It's about love. It's about consequence.
Yes, it is. It is.
You know, and consequence, I always love, because it's really based on faith and love.
Yes, it is. And to hearken back to the metaphysical aspect, as Hermes, it's so obviously written into this script when you listen to it, because he's coaching Orpheus and saying, look, I'll tell you where the real road lies. It's between your ears, behind your eyes. This is the path to paradise, or it's the road to ruin. He's telling him where we spend our mental energy magnifies. Mind your thoughts, your feelings, your belief systems. It's written into this script. Hermes is, if you look at her Hermeticism and the history of Hermeticism and what Hermes are like, it is very metaphysical, you know? So like, I get to be the ambassador of a message that's actually a part of my daily life, which is kind of nice.
Well, I'm now, you got me very excited. I'm looking forward to having you guide me tomorrow night. Nice. Again, if people want to come see you, Center Theater Group till May 29th. Where do you go after LA?
San Diego.
Oh, okay. Well, you're here. And of course, Levi, you can find online.
We're head up the West Coast.
Yeah, well, so be sure you see him. If you're out there tomorrow night, you'll see me. Hopefully, I'll get to see you tomorrow night. We'll have to try to say hi to
you. Let's say hey afterwards. And thank you for having me on, Billy. It's always fun talking to you.
Levi, it's great seeing you. And please keep me in the loop. Whatever you got going on, you're always welcome here.
Of course. Thank you.
Take care, Levi. Bye, honey. Oh, my God. And now backstage, another one of my friends who I've known even longer, the great illusionist, Jimmy James. I knew about Jimmy James when I was an itty bitty little gay boy in a Boston suburb. And I was sitting home and I had just come home from, I want to say college, but maybe high school even. And my mother always had on CBS. We were a CBS family. CBS soaps until 3 o'clock when, 4 o'clock, excuse me, Donahue came on. And I saw this.
Can Marilyn sing Diamonds of Abyss?
Yes, for $100, sure. Ladies and gentlemen, here in performance, live, you are Jimmy James. That is hard to believe. Once again, Miss Marilyn Monroe.
A kiss on the hand may be quite transcendental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend. A kiss may be grand, but it won't pay the rent on your humble flat or help you at the automat. Men grow cold as girls grow old, and we all lose our charms in the end. But square cut or pear shape, these rocks don't lose their shape. Diamonds are a girl's best friend.
And I'm here with the fabulous Jimmy James. Hi, sweetie.
Hi, baby. How are you?
Oh, my God. You know, it brings me back. I'm sure you're tired of seeing the clips, but it's magic to me.
Well, no, I don't get tired of seeing the clips. Whenever I see that one, I'm taken back to the most terrifying moment when I was walking up to that microphone. The terrifying moment was that I went blank on the lyrics.
No.
Yeah. And I was like, oh God, what is the first lyric to Diamonds Are Girls' Best Friend? What is the first lyric? And I was in absolute panic mode. And, you know, the Phil Donahue brings me on, and I get to the microphone, and I just said, just open your mouth. And I went, a kiss on the head. I had sung that song 100 times, but I went blank. So I just said, open your mouth, a kiss on the, and it just came out. Thank God. I was absolutely blank, and it was a live broadcast.
Yeah, sure.
And then it would have been there forever.
And was that your first major television interview?
Yeah, I had been on PM Magazine. It was a local thing and it went national. But Donahue was one that just blew it out of the water. I had been touring for a year or two, you know, little gay clubs everywhere. And it's just amazing what television can do. It just blew it out of the water. That was May of 1987. That's how long ago.
Okay,
that
so
was.
Yeah, so I was a senior in high school. I mean, my God, it's, and you know, it seems so. You know, I hate to say that it seems like such an innocent time, but like seeing a man as Marilyn singing live, which was the other thing which blew my mind, seemed like such a novelty. We'd never heard of such a thing. It was bizarre.
Well, the ones that paved the way was like Jim Bailey and Charles Pierce.
Right.
And Jim Bailey was the one that I looked up to because he specialized in Judy Garland. And even though I was trying to do Judy, but he had that market cornered for Judy. So I really didn't know who Marilyn was. And I know people always think, you know, I was like 3 years old when she died. So, you know, in May, I'm going to turn 63. That's how long ago. I was like 27 on Donahue.
And I found this picture. And I believe which I don't even know which
this
is you.
Okay, so this is a photo match. This right. is, I'm on the left doing a.
Oh wow!
I'm on the left doing a test for the makeup, like in my bathroom at night. Nobody knew. I hadn't started doing Marilyn yet. I was doing test shots, selfies. When back in the day, you take your picture and you had to wait 3 days to get it developed.
Oh
anyways,
God! Yeah.
All these years later, I find a picture of Marilyn that's kind of at that same angle, but her eyes are closed. So I do this to show people, because I knew as a makeup artist the similarity in the bone structure, but this is to show people the angle of the jaw, the facial structure, the lids. Like if I would have closed my eyes.
Right, now I can see that, right.
Yeah, and even like the shape of the
lips.
And
even the nose. And the nose, yeah, of course. It's, you know, it's fascinating because I had always heard that who was it? Somebody told you that you had the same bone structure as Marilyn initially, right?
No, nobody saw it but me.
You saw it?
Yeah, because I was studying theatrical makeup in college and I thought I wanted to be in show business so bad, but I thought I'm never going to be in show business. I'm like going to school in San Antonio and I mean, now San Antonio has a Sam Ash music store. Like, that's really coming a long way. But back then, there was no hope. There was no way I was going to ever get in show business. And so I thought, well, you know what? I'll be a makeup artist, maybe, you know? Mm-hmm. And as I was studying people's bone structures, I would play with my face a lot. So I knew the bone structure of my face. And I was always a chubby boy. And then I lost a lot of weight. And then I suddenly had a better bone structure to work with. And then
I could see the bones, right?
Right, because the face went down. Then I saw a picture of Marilyn in the book Life Goes to the Movies, a Philippe Halsman photograph where she's in that draped white dress and she's looking into the camera. Well, because when I had lost so much weight, I would stare at myself in the camera like that, like going like, oh, look at this new face. And when I saw a picture of her, I was like, that's my bone structure. But Billy, I did not know who Marilyn was because my era was Sonny and Cher, Diana Ross and the Supremes, Elton John. You know, like that was my era. And so.
So you weren't thinking this.
No. And that is me.
I mean, look at that.
That's me.
I mean, that is staggering. It really is staggering.
I was just.
And then there was another one too.
That one's by Michael Childers.
Oh my God. Oh, Michael, of course, it's such a genius.
Yeah.
And I got this one. Oh, those were the, you and I have so much to talk about because you have just had the most extraordinary life. But before we talk about your life, let's talk about a hot topic that's going on right now, which is Kim Kardashian. In the Marilyn dress. Now, I'm going to show. There is Kim, and there is the dress. Now, they just released this very long story today that what we now understand is that she tried on the replica first and realized it fit, but did not take into account that the fabric had some give. So when she went to try on the actual dress, that fat ass could only get so far. Had to lose the weight. Julian, Ripley's Believe It or Not said you can wear it on the red carpet and then switch into the replica. That's it. You get 15 minutes. Do you think that she should have been able to wear it?
I love Kim Kardashian.
Okay.
Selfishly, I feel, and I know a lot of the Marilyn, I feel like she shouldn't have worn it because I always knew that dress was delicate.
Right.
And fragile. I should say fragile. That's mm-hmm. what I've always known about their dress. But I will
have
say
you seen
this,
the dress?
Yes. When it was okay. on sale at Christie's the first time around, and it sold mm-hmm. for $1 million. Later yeah. on, it sold for $4 million. I mean, right. can you imagine? If you would have come up yeah. with $500,000 and me $500,000,
we'd own the dress.
And then
I know.
A few years later, we'll split $4 million.
and not let Kardashian anywhere near it.
But so I was, in one way, I was like, oh my God, the fabric, it's going to disintegrate. Yeah. But then in another way, it is the first time, other than the Marilyn photos and mainly black and white that we see her in, that we've never seen a human being inside
right,
the dress.
Just a form right there.
Just a form. Yeah.
Right. And she says, and her argument is, it is bringing the dress and Marilyn to a young generation that maybe doesn't know it.
And when I did Marilyn, I felt I was bringing Marilyn
well, okay.
to a younger generation as well.
So you and Kim are similar.
And Marilyn lives on as though she has a publicist even today.
Right. And, you know, it's so funny that it started as this sketch that you and I know that our friend Bob Mackie.
The great Bob Mackie. You can't
the
say
great
Bob
Mackie.
Let's say the great Bob Mackie.
No, and it's funny. And I have to say, I was in touch with Bob because I was like, you know, do you want to talk about this? And the answer was no. But yeah, he's so generous. He's like, look, I was just the kid in the back room making a sketch.
Yeah.
Because he was working for the designer. So, you know, it's so many hands have had their fingers on this iconic piece of Americana, including you, because your dress, you had a dress that was very similar
I
as
did.
Well. On Donahue,
mine
right?
had mine had prongs, and so when I sat on the Donahue chair, I really never sat in that dress before. It was not meant for sitting; it was just for performing. So when I sat down on the fabric chair of Donahue, I could feel the prongs grabbing onto the fabric and like wanting to let go of the stones
oh, God,
in my ass.
Don't do that.
Yeah, so that I was like, oh my God, the prongs are sticking to the chair. But now Marilyn's dress was not prongs. There were three different sizes of crystals, Swarovski crystal, three different sizes. And it was like a large size, a medium size, and a small size. And each one had a hole through it. Each bead is hand embroidered and hand knotted. So underneath the dress is like lots of little tails of it's furry on the inside from the flesh colored thread.
Tool, like, yeah.
Like it's furry, full of the tails. So if one bead came off, it wouldn't unravel the whole
yeah.
lot.
Oh, because they're all individually knotted. Like
individually.
Good pearls. If good pearls are like that. Yeah.
There's thousands of beads. So each one, they had to like knot it. And they cut it and then do the next bead, knot it and then cut it. So there's little tails of fur of thread all on the inside. It's amazing. But when Kim Kardashian wore it, one, I like that a human is in it and I want to see it. The other was, oh my God, don't desecrate the, like, don't ruin it. So fat, fragile.
Right, right. Well, like she said, she had to lose 17 pounds and that was just to get one of her arms on. So you have a great project that you're finally, I mean, you and I have talked about this project, but you're finally working on it. I'm so excited. So, the boy who was Marilyn, you're finally trying to get a documentary together. You have more footage that nobody has ever seen that you're trying to share with us, which I just think is fantastic.
So I have a lot of, I don't want to get involved in this project unless I see that people are interested. So by that, I mean, we set up a GoFundMe and I want to see if people are really interested in making this happen because it is going to take a lot of my time. There is a place, I'm in San Antonio right now where I'm doing my final COVID cabaret show. And I'm going to have people in the house, but I'm in San Antonio. And for the summer, I want to work on this project, The Boy Who Was Marilyn. We need to transfer the tapes digitally. There's about 100. It's just
exhausting.
It's exhausting. Really, but I do have a place that does it professionally. And it's like $20 a tape.
Right. Oh, I know. I've done it. I know.
So it's a lot. So if people are into it, if they donate, I will get into it. Because otherwise, you know, I got into the recording industry. I recorded Fashionista. I wrote the song. Anyway, and I do other stuff now. But I am proud of my Maryland years. And if people are into it, and so far, the donations have been robust, and I'm so happy.
Oh, my God. I am so happy. And you've set a very low threshold for yourself. And I think that's because you don't want to scare people off, which is very smart.
This funding is to make the sizzle reel to pitch.
Right, and get the digitalization of the stuff you need. I'm just going to put it there. So I'm going to put, though, the link in this video. All you have to do is click and pay. That's it. Because because look, there was like we talked about Jim Bailey. I remember going to see Jim Bailey do the full Judy concert with a full orchestra. Well, where is this? I mean, I know there are clips, but we want to save this footage. It's part of our heritage.
And as you go through it, you just uncover something else, and then the photographs have to be digitized too.
Okay, let's talk about photos, because you've got pictures. Jimmy, my God. Okay, I'm going to just, first off, tell me what I'm looking at here.
I wanted you to capture, I don't know if you captured it, the address of the house.
Oh, okay, hold on, let me put it back up there. Oh, no, it isn't, because it had to get cropped, but because you had the Marilyn picture as well.
Okay. So this is me as a little kid. I must be, I don't know, 12. I'm at the far left.
Okay.
And that's my dad. Well, the address says 2514, and that's where we lived in that house, 2514. Okay. Do you have the Maryland picture?
I don't. No.
So then I wanted you to see Maryland standing in front. She was kind of, I think she's still a starlet with long hair. And she was standing in front of her address. And the numbers are exactly the same, just in a different position.
Oh, okay. I get what you mean.
It was spooky. When I found her standing in front of that address, I thought, those numbers look familiar. And then I went back and I was like, wait a minute. That's the address we lived at. But just her numbers were just, I mean, if it was the lottery, I would have won. the address up there.
Hold on. I think actually we just found it. Well, I'm just getting a text right now. Yeah.
There you go. Now look at her address. 4215.
4215.
And look at mine. 2514.
Spooky. It's almost eerie. It's like it was meant to be.
And where those numbers are on the other side of that wall is the bedroom where I developed Marilyn. It's spooky as hell.
It is spooky.
I mean, what are the chances?
But now, speaking of spooky, hold on. Let's talk about this. Come on.
I'd like to tell you that we're at Madame Tussauds and it's two wax figures, but it's the real Liberace with me.
One of them is a little wax. Can you explain what happened in this picture? First off, he has almost as much cleavage as you.
He came to see Lacage in Atlantic City in the mid 80s. And he was so sweet. And so this is where I get like when people's cameras don't work and like, you know, I'm like,
don't you want to kill Liberace? Yeah.
Because he was so sweet. Everybody, all the queens, their cameras were messed up. And he goes, that's all right.
You got the picture. And picture it is. It's so gorgeous.
I mean, when you take these pictures, you don't know what it's going to mean like years later.
No, and you can't see it right then and there. You had to wait a week before you got it back. And it could be that he's like this, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so great. What a great picture. Was he nice? Did he like the show?
He loved the show. He's very sweet, very gracious. And he looked at me and goes, well, now now this is something, you know. It was just very sweet.
It was something else is what it was. Okay. Here's someone else from your past.
Oh, yeah. So now this is years later. I performed for Elton John in New York City at the St. Regis Hotel for his AIDS benefit. Raised a lot of money for his Chopard watches.
Oh, yeah, right. But you've known Elton over the years. You've had an on and off relationship because, as I recall, the first time you met him, he was like, oh, yeah, he's going to know this and know that. And he couldn't believe how good you were.
Well, it was at the party when I first started singing. You know, I always open the Voices show with me singing. So he's just sitting there going like, what is this? And then I did Eartha Kitt and he was like, okay, like an Eartha Kitt impression. And then when I got to the Cher part of the show, I talked about how he was on the Cher show with Bette Midler. And then he warmed up because then he knew, like I knew about him, you know, being on the Cher show. And then I went into my Cher impression. And by then he was like all in.
Hey.
And then after the performance, because, you know, everybody's looking at him. It's at the St. Regis.
Yeah, right.
And they're all looking
and
at him.
And it is like, his event.
It's his event. And if he don't like me, they're not going to like me.
Right.
So afterwards, he said, come over here. He hugged me. And okay, kiss on the lips.
Wow.
I can die. Elton John kissed me on the lips. And he just raised my hand to everybody and said, I approve. Like, you know.
Oh, see?
So, and that was good.
Okay, wait, now we got a comment. Hold on. I can't even see. So hold on. Another great show, Billy. It's always a delight to see Jimmy, who I've been seeing so many times over the years at many venues. I hope he knows how much pleasure he's brought the world over the years. Thank you, Steve Hatchett. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Look, at you're giving people pleasure.
Well, I did these living room concerts now. This marks 2 years since I started. I mean, you do the same thing. We just can't believe it's been 2 years. Like,
no, it's staggering, really, when you think of it. And how many shows have you done?
I've never counted, but it was every Thursday for 2 years.
And one of my favorite things, and, you know, it's appropriate that it's just before Mother's Day, because so many of your shows, we see your mother sitting in the chair just off camera, and she is like your biggest fan. And sometimes she's just kind of sitting there doing her own thing. And sometimes she's like, yeah, all right, whatever, sing.
Yeah.
You just seem to have this wonderful relationship with her.
Well, today for our final show, she'll be here with me. I'm going to do something special because it's Mother's Day. But this is our final COVID cabaret show. I might start later on in the summer. I might do stuff on YouTube. I'm going to experiment. And maybe you can advise me about Facebook. I don't know anymore. I used to have 150 people.
No, I know.
And now they squeeze the algorithm. I'm like 40 people. It's like,
you know, what's interesting is that if you do Facebook and YouTube, it helps. But it's so funny because when you and I started these, you know, and it's been over 2 years. It's been crazy, Jimmy. It seemed like there were hundreds and hundreds of people who were watching live because everyone was home. They had nothing to do, nothing to watch. And that's what we were doing. We were keeping people entertained. Now that people are back at work, they don't watch live. Like I can see there's like, you know, 20 people watching live. But over the weekend, all those old fans will catch up. So that's what's good about YouTube. So yeah, I'll help you with that. Absolutely.
So if I do YouTube, you think I should do it on the weekends?
You know, it depends. I think people aren't sitting home to watch it anymore, but if it's on YouTube, they can watch it whenever they want.
Right.
So I think that's a better thing. And I can't believe that you're stopping. You know, don't stop. Don't say this is it. Because again, don't be like Cher. Oh, it's a farewell. You know, whatever.
I got another picture. I'll probably be jonesing for my tribe again.
Well,
in the summer, I'll be lonely and ask Varla's doing her shows in Provincetown. and I'll be.
Yeah. Okay. Let me ask you about P-Town, because the last couple times you were at, you were someplace different. Where were you? A plush room? Is that where you were?
I was at the Red Room, and you know, it was right after the second wave hit.
Yeah.
And it was a club that was underground. I loved the club. It was a dance club, and I love dance clubs because they
were underwear parties at night, Jim.
Yeah. They have all the bells and whistles of mirror balls and that. But people didn't want to go into enclosed places. Yeah. So I kind of.
It was hard.
Varla was outdoors by the swimming pool.
Right, by the pool.
Yeah,
yeah, so and over at the Pilgrim House, they were on the parking lot. So, what do you think about Provincetown? Because again, I haven't been around as long as you, but I remember when it was this subversive little, like, people loved going into these little clubs, and it was our own little tribe. And then it became very family oriented, and you had the kids, and I hate the kids. And then it became this party town, and everybody has become segregated again. You got the women, you got the gays, you got the kids. How do you see the audiences in P-Town?
I'm a person that doesn't like to divide. Mm. I don't like, the blacks here, the gays here, and the straights here.
Yeah.
I like everything mixed. I don't like the weekly, like the Bear Week, the Women's Week,
this week,
or that week, the Family Week. I don't like that because guess what's the most popular week? It's Carnival, which means come on.
Everybody.
It means everybody. I wish they would just stop with those specialty weeks.
Yeah.
But the reason I'm not going to P-Town, the main big reason is housing. You cannot.
Yeah.
Get
it is
housing.
No, it's impossible. It is impossible. I don't know how the young gay kids do it. Although some of them say that there's like 10 of them in a room and they just hope that they all get lucky and they don't have to sleep there. I'll tell you, you get lucky with me after we have sex. Get out. I don't need you to stay.
I don't know about you, but I never bought property in Provincetown.
No, never.
Because, it was good for the summer. It was only good July and August. And then you got the hell out of there.
Yeah.
And now
No, I don't, I don't know about you, but a lot of us that were, in our 50s and 60s, we made very bad financial choices.
There was no Susie Orman.
No, although you said something great. Well, we could have used Susie. You said something lovely in an interview recently, and you brought up a woman who gave you one of your first gigs in Provincetown and somebody who was so close to me, Phyllis.
Phyllis Schlossberg.
Who we just lost, last year.
We lost her.
I adored Phyllis.
That was a power to be reckoned with. I mean, Phyllis could have been one of the best agents if she had ever gone into being an agent. She believed in me. She championed me. She gave me such good advice. Mm. She was
so smart.
So smart. Times where I thought, oh, Phyllis, nobody's in town. Nobody's can't I cancel this show? No, you're going to go do this. You're going to go do that. And she was 99% of the time right.
Yeah.
She knew
and
that
even when
the
she left me town. Yeah. Even when she left and was in New York, she would text me, I hear you're in town. I'm like, Jesus, she's got eyes everywhere. I mean, that the days of that type of person, that's gone. It is gone.
Yeah.
And with Rick Murray selling the Crown and Anchor, I mean, we hope that it will continue just like the post office continues, but it's different. It's a different time. But I certainly
always knew that there was going to come a time when more people found out about Provincetown. It was just a matter of time. And with social media, boom, it just exploded because people could share pictures of themselves
in real time
and videos of Provincetown, and the word gets out. And then when they had the COVID explosion last year, well, that was on international news, Provincetown.
Yeah, that we were the first ones to have breakthrough cases, right? And it was a gay guy that figured it out, all things. All right, we're going back to your life. Jimmy, please explain.
Oh my God. I love.
First off, I love the picture. I love all the tchotchkes everywhere. It's just killing me. All right, tell me about this.
She has beautiful tchotchkes. I performed for Whoopi Goldberg in the most beautiful, picturesque winter wonderland. It was a Christmas party, and a lot of people got snowed in and couldn't make it. It was the most beautiful Christmas I had ever seen, with snow falling outside the windows. She had decorations for all faiths, oh, you know, wow. Christian, Jew,
Muslim, whatever.
Muslim, and what's the
Kwanzaa? The black
Kwanzaa. Kwanzaa. Yeah, yep. All of it. She had gingerbread houses, authentic, like amazing. It was beautiful, and she's one of my idols, because her one woman show was a big inspiration for me.
Oh, sure.
It was because she did so much with very little. It was a stool and water and maybe a rag on her head. She
that was
did
it.
Like
yep, a hat.
Her persona. It's like, it proved to me that your acting abilities come from within, you know? So,
Okay. We've talked about this before, but I think it's just such an amazing story. Let's just tell it very briefly. Go.
Okay. This is perhaps the most misidentified photo of Marilyn Monroe in the world. Artists,
because it's not Marilyn.
Because it's not Marilyn. It's me, photographed by Greg Gorman for the LA Iwerks campaign.
Greg Gorman.
It ran only once in Andy Warhol's Interview magazine, and then
anniversary issue, right?
So the Monroe Estate back then, not now, but the Monroe Estate back then wanted to file lawsuits against me and Greg Gorman and LA Iwerks, so they had to pull from everything. There's the ball in his campaign.
And then it resurfaces
22 years later.
As a stamp.
In Africa.
In Africa.
This
a tribute
is an artist
to Marilyn, and it's a picture of you.
This is an artist rendition, thinking that that's Marilyn. But, well, the one on the left is Marilyn.
Yes.
And the one on the right is me. And they realized the faux pas, and they pulled it. I didn't sue them. I only got two of those that I ordered on the internet.
Oh, really?
And maybe they're still available. Who knows? But
and then there's this collage of all the Marilyn stamps, and here you are, front and center.
Yeah, I got that's the sheet I own. I own two of those sheets.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so, again, you know, I don't think kids get it, that it was such, even 10 years ago, it was such a different world. We didn't have access to fact check something like that. You know, you asked about the picture of Marilyn in front of her house, and my assistant Monica pulls it up and puts it on the screen. You couldn't do things like that 10 years ago, 15 years ago. But you were able to do this. Jimmy, what is this?
This is the trio from the Billboard in Times Square with Linda Evangelista, and it showed in 1996-97 in Times Square, in the center of Times Square.
Oh yeah.
I'm so proud of that, because I had a vision. I had a vision in my head that I would be seen somewhere as Judy, Marilyn, and Betty. Those are all three of me. I shaved my eyebrows for this photo shoot so I could do three different eyebrows.
Well, of course.
And Rocco La Spada shot that.
Is that who did it?
Rocco and Charles La Spada, they shot that. And in Linda Evangelista, the campaign was, I think I sent you the whole thing.
If you did, they didn't put it up here for me. I'm sorry.
The whole billboard. So they can, maybe people can find it.
Oh, God. It's just, I'll have to look. But you have had the most extraordinary career. When you look back, is there one moment? I mean, I suppose the Donahue moment has to be the defining moment, or at least the breakthrough moment.
that suddenly exploded my career.
What was your life like, the difference the day before Donahue and the day after Donahue? Was it night and day?
And it made it easier to get bookings.
Now, you and I have talked. You retired doing the Marilyn, the body, the face. You still do the voice, but you've retired her. And you said something that I think is so smart, which was Marilyn died at, how old?
36.
And so what am I going to do? You know, it's funny. Every once in a while on those Marilyn retrospectives, that woman, who was her stand-in? Eleanor, what was her name?
Evelyn Moriarty.
Oh, okay. And every once in a while, she'll come out like as at 120 and say, this is what Marilyn would look like now. And I'm like, oh, Jesus, go back home.
She's dead, by the way.
Well, then
so
she
there's
is
no
what
120,
Marilyn
but
well, but she would do that. She'd come out as an old woman in
Billy,
dresses.
Billy, I planned for this like when I was 30, I was like 36 is just down the road. And it was kind of.
And what do you do?
It was freaking me out. Do I want to be a 38-year-old Marilyn? Do I want to be a 40-year-old Marilyn? Do I want to be a 50-year-old Marilyn?
Right.
Do I want to be a 60-year-old Marilyn? No, I don't. I don't.
Well, and it's also, you're not a 60-year-old Marilyn because you're a 60-year-old man playing a 37-year-old or 36-year-old Marilyn.
36.
Because we don't know what a 60-year-old Marilyn would look like.
No.
You can't, I mean, it's unfair. And I think that you did it up until, were you 50 when you stopped?
No, I stopped at 36.
Is that the last time you put on the dress?
The last time you can see me as Marilyn is in my music video, Who Wants to Be Your Lover? It's on YouTube. That's the last time anyone saw me as Marilyn. That was it.
And do you ever once in a while just say, I just want to do it for myself?
I did it so much.
You're
I don't miss it. I don't miss it. It was a beautiful moment in my life. But there were struggles that I will probably talk about in the documentary. There was a lot of struggles. This wasn't like the RuPaul world of drag.
No,
it
no,
was
no,
a
no.
different
drag
thing.
Drag was very different.
It was very different. You got judged and you got like not.
It was not fun. It
sophisticated
wasn't fun.
Sophisticated people have always gotten my act. But right. You try to sell that back then. Try to sell me to a theater.
Right.
They were not.
Because you were not. But you know, that was the thing that's great. And about you now is that you were never a club drag queen who got up on a bar and was paid with a couple of free drinks and a blowjob. You know,
I was, but not as Marilyn though.
No. Well, all right.
You don't
oh my God. I hear mother.
You don't know about Beverly the Slut? Oh, I got to
no,
show you those
I missed
pictures.
That. Oh, my God.
Wait, it all comes under performance artist. Performance artist.
Oh.
Performance artist.
That's how, well, all right. Well,
but not
that's,
for Marilyn.
I think, for not for Marilyn.
But you're right. I never used Marilyn for, like, to stand on
a
bar.
Yeah, right.
No, never. And much to my financial detriment, I never accepted tips. There were no tipping was allowed. So there's no photographs of me as Marilyn with dollar bills.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Beverly, you will find dollar bills.
Oh, my God. What is happening over there? Are you having a party?
Yes, a party is a look, my friend Kathy showed up. We went to high school together.
Kathy. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
This is Billy Masters.
Kathy's very pretty.
She's very pretty.
She's like a Charlene Tilton a little.
What?
He says you're like a Charlene Tilton.
I'm sure she gets that a lot.
We get, look at all the, we've got all these.
Oh, wait, you're giving
up.
All right, when is the concert on tonight?
Tonight, 9 Eastern, 8 Central, and 6 Pacific.
6 Pacific. So that's going to be in just like another hour and a half. Oh, my God.
Yeah, and people have flown in. They have,
oh my
people
God.
Have flown in that
and
I
how
never
long
met
will you
before.
Sing? Oh,
what?
Well, how long will you sing?
Tonight it'll probably
an hour, hour and a half, an hour.
An hour.
All right. I want it because I know I'm already running over, but you know, I adore you and I can talk to you for God knows we can talk forever. I just want to remind people that again, The Boy Who Was Marilyn is the documentary you're trying to get done. There is a GoFundMe going on. Oh no, not that's Thirsty Burlington's GoFundMe. Forget that. GoFundMe. And it's the link is there. We're going to put it underneath so that people can donate because I want to see this documentary.
Yeah, I gotta transfer these tapes before time runs out.
Yeah, for you and me both.
Yeah,
and anything I know, and anything I can do for you, Jimmy. All you have to do is ask.
Thank you.
People should know that I had this idea when I heard about it, and we were trying to figure it out, and we realized it was now or never.
I know.
So
I know.
Because you've got a busy and you've got a birthday coming up and you've got a lot of touring coming up.
Yes.
And people, if they want to know everything about you, jimmyjames.com, your website has all your tour dates. It has the documentary information there.
Yeah.
There's pictures, there's videos, and they can watch you tonight. Is it on Facebook Live, right?
Facebook Live, facebook.com/ Jimmy James Hollywood, all together. Jimmy James Hollywood.
Jimmy, I love you. Thank you for doing the show at the last minute.
Thank you, Billy Masters.
You and I will talk soon, okay?
Thank you, Billy.
Okay, bye, sweetheart. Everyone, thanks for watching. Sorry we ran a little late, but you know, I got a lot of things to talk about. You just make sure that... look at the comment section. All the links will be there because, you know, these are great projects. Also, check out all the gossip on billymasters.com. There's nude photos. This thing's maybe nude photos of Jimmy James. Who knows what I've got? Anyway, thank you for watching. We will see you next week. As usual, I am Billy Masters. And just remember that I'm trying to look for my outro music. Where the hell did it go? Oh, my God. I think it went. Oh, no, there it is. You know, this StreamYard, they're fucking me over. Anyway, thank you for watching Billy Masters Live. I am Billy Masters. And just remember, if we're here, we're live. Oh, Jimmy, stay, and I'll talk to you after we end. Bye, guys.